We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Nelson.
All right, so cool. Joining me today is Joaquin Flores, Spanish name, and we're going to be talking about Ukraine. Now, sir, you've written a long series on Ukraine, and you've done a lot of videos on YouTube, etc., and on your site, and I'm jumping right into phase three because that's where we're at right now, the Ukrainian failed state, and you have this analysis here. Now, we have the United States backing this Pravi Sektor and Sobosa parties, and they've been pressuring Poroshenko, the leader there, to take a more Banderist position. Well, I guess we ought to explain what that means. Who is Stefan Banderas and what are those positions?
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me on the show again. I'm glad to be here. And basically, right. So we have phase three, which is, you know, as your listeners know, you have basically this sort of combined Arab Spring and color revolution tactic, which the U.S. has been using and refining. And, you know, it's based on the, like, commonly discussed things involving, like, hoaxes, false flags, but also the classical coup maneuvers. And it's, you know, people know already that you have the first phase is just basically where you have the color revolution, where you have protests. And then the Western media says, oh, because there's protesters, the government actually has to disband, right? Which never happens in places like France or England or the United States. But suddenly, if it happens in another country that the U.S. doesn't like, then because there's protesters, which, you know, you might have 10,000 or 20,000 people in the streets, right, which is maybe, I don't know, a fraction of a percent of the population. Therefore, the government no longer has legitimacy. And then what happens in phase two is
and
the
half
U.S.
half the time, these are rent-a-crowds sometimes, like Operation
Ajax. Half the time, they're rent-a-crowds.
And there was a color revolution in Ukraine, an attempted one, it was back in 2005 and 6,
right.
The Orange Revolution, yeah.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have rent-a-crowds, you got people being bussed in, and you have high unemployment in the world, in the U.S., everywhere with high unemployment. And everyone needs an extra 5 or 10 or 20 bucks in their pocket, and they might not be political or really know what's going on. Another thing that happens in these early phases, in phase, you know, one, is people are protesting not for the government to step down, but you've got maybe 500 people protesting about electric bills, you know, 1,000 people protesting because they don't like the local mayor. Another 1,000 people are there, just like anywhere, right? So then what happens is that CNN and the BBC say, they basically blanket all these protesters who are there asking for reforms, changes, or just, you know, venting basic grievances, which they have the right in these countries to do, which is often overlooked. And then they're saying, oh, they're calling for, you know, the regime to step down. And it's just not what the people are saying.
Kind of like how the mass media colored the Occupy movement all as communist. I mean, most of the people were there opposing the bailouts or the Fed or the wars or something. Other than being communist,
right,
but they find the five communists in the crowd and they go, see, they're all commies.
Right. You had communists, anarchists, but you had a lot of people who were constitutionalists, libertarians. You had Ron Paul supporters. You had people talking about end the Fed. And, you know, and that's how they called it, like it was some left wing thing when it was really kind of transcending that left right stuff. But right. So with the phases, to get to the question then is phase two, then you basically just have an Arab Spring type uprising where these protesters are suddenly armed. The Western media keeps calling them protesters, even though they're like organized as militias and they're armed. And then they basically like try to overthrow the government and install a democracy. And then in that phase, either it fails or there's a prolonged civil war. And then in phase three, let's say in Ukraine, where the government kind of stayed together through this coup, you have a transition from a nominally stable pro-Western government into an intentionally made failed state, which is ruled by various like extremist, ideological or religious, you know, warlords and local leaders. And then you kind of basically get a lot of shelling and explosions, which destroys gas lines, infrastructure, roads, electrical, industrial stuff. And that's one of the main goals of the U.S. tactic. It doesn't really matter in many ways, right? Who ends up in power, so long as just stuff gets destroyed. So what we can see,
if you can break it, that's good enough. Plan B. And in this case, they're backing neo-Nazis.
And they're backing neo-Nazis. So the question about Bandera
might be Salafi jihadist or Zionist Jews or whatever. They always pick some kind of extremist, though, because they have very predictable behavior. They can't get along with anybody else, and they're the perfect people.
There you go. It's got to be people who are polarizing, and it's got to be people because they're trying to create civil war. So you can't pick like these. You can't pick people who kind of are who bring people together. You got to bring polarizing figures. So in the Middle East, it's going to be the Salafists, and in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe, it's going to be the Nazis because people know. You know, people know what happened to their grandfathers and to their parents and grandfathers not very long ago in historical terms. And so this guy Bandera was basically a guy, he's like from the territory of Ukraine, but at this time in history there really wasn't like a strong Ukrainian identity. And what is unique about him is that he was an agent of the Nazis, and he was also himself a supporter of Adolf Hitler. And he organized, he was kind of like a PR front man so that to kind of put a local face on what the Germans were doing in of this part of the Soviet Union and in the Republic of Ukraine. And so they basically took people who were from the far a western part of the country who had a mixture of this Ukrainian and Galician identity. And Galicians are, there was like a, not to take like too long of a detour, but people know that like in modern nation states, you have like national minorities and in the areas of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire and in the larger Polish-Lithuanian kingdom, and in the Russian Empire, there's like other nationality called Galicians. And in the 200-300 years ago, they did have their own kingdom, which is right along the northern border of the Carpathian Mountains, sort of like on the north of Romania, for people who are like looking at their maps right now. But right, so this Bandera guy was given basically a lot of money and told to like mess things up. And like a lot of people who were not German Nazis, but were like were local kind of Nazis, they did things that were even crazier than the Nazis did. If if people are sophisticated enough to like understand that, I don't want to get deep into things that Nazis are accused of versus things that Nazis did, but people. What's interesting about this, Rai, is that people who were Nazi supporters, like in the peripheral countries and in Eastern Europe, were more subjected to anti-Nazi propaganda, and they kind of, so they're actually kind of more like neo-Nazis, right? They were kind of like Spielberg Nazis, because they were acting upon what they believed Nazis to be, and I can't really get into whether that's true or not, but the point is that what's indisputable is that Bandera was leading, whole bunch of people to get killed and, kill a bunch of people. You had mass graves and it was a big polarizing event and a lot of Poles got killed. A lot of ethnic Russians and Ruthenians got killed and a lot of Ukrainians got killed. And it was just a, part of the German war machine. So,
and also I think an important point there is that front was fighting the Russians almost exclusively, and so it's a very anti-Russian faction.
Exactly, and that's an important point to raise, because Nazism and neo-Nazism in Eastern Europe isn't really like so much about like say the doctrines of National Socialism. It's actually just like a shorthand for Russophobia, if that makes sense.
It's not like. Oh, I think Americans think of it as sort of like a white power type of thing.
Right.
Hating blacks and gays or something. But in Eastern Europe, it's just hating Russians.
Yeah, right. It's got very little to do with
which in the U.S., that was just colored as anti-communist when they were hating Russians. So,
right. Yeah, it's a McCarthyism and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's, right. So basically, just long story short, is that you had in Europe, of course, following World War II, you had Operation Gladio, which people know about, and maybe you can, you know,
give Gladio A and B.
Right. And so so basically Gladio B developed, you know, kind of for the Middle East, which is kind of like what you would call the Arab Spring tactic, is very much connected to Gladio B. And the color revolution tactic is very much connected to Gladio A. And so like the synthesis of Gladio A and B is kind of like the synthesis of the color revolution plus Arab Spring tactic, which is being used in Ukraine. So, and so long story short, the American Gladio projects in Eastern Europe were connected to the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. And in Ukraine, this was called Radio Svoboda, which means freedom. A little bit, you know, Orwellian use of the word, right? Because they're neo-Nazis. And out of Radio Svoboda organized, was the kind of like, got really, really big after the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually. And in the early 90s, it began really to like openly form militias. So people who were banned from the USSR after World War II, and their political heirs living in, you know, Western Germany, back then when there was East and West Germany, people living in France, they were expatriate communities. And then in the 90s, they kind of came back. They got millions of dollars from nowhere, you know, from who knows where, right? And then this Radio Svoboda, and out of that grew the National Socialist Assembly, which was then rebranded the Social Nationalist Assembly, which was then rebranded the Svoboda Party after Radio Svoboda. And these are basically Banderists. And then there's kind of, and then as the Svoboda in the 2000s began to try to kind of go a little bit more mainstream, and the leaders wear suits and have like a regularly printed newspaper and website that kind of looked more mainstream-ish, then you kind of got like the more guys in their early 20s and teenagers who, oh, these are sellouts, they're not Nazi enough. So then you got like the spin-off, more radical groups, and those together we call the Pravi sector, right? So that basically...
Well, let me back up to your sarcasm of they got money out of nowhere. The Radio Free Europe was originally like the very beginning of OSS and CIA's fuckery, to be shorthand with it. And then now... they don't do it so direct. They use NGOs, but they usually have a medium in between the NGO and themselves. And in this case, it's been the National Endowment of Democracy that gets financed completely, 100 million or so a year by the U.S. government. But then they divvy out that money to all these different NGOs who are supposedly non-government organizations, where they're getting their money from a government organization.
Right, right, exactly.
The ones paying for the rent-a-crowds and snipers and all the rest of it, yeah.
Right. Any responsible government, like Russia has done in the last couple of years, would force these NGOs to register as foreign agents, just the way that AIPAC in the U.S. should be forced to register as a foreign agent.
Last guy to challenge him on that was Robert Kennedy, and then he got killed by a Palestinian, allegedly.
Right, I'm sure that's what happened, too.
Uh-huh, yeah. I don't think anybody believes that anymore.
But I think, you know, not to digress, my friend, but I think that says a lot that people just don't believe this stuff anymore. I mean, it's kind of like a minority opinion. I mean, I can talk to people in the U.S. and not share what I think and just kind of pick their brain without asking leading questions. And, like, no one believes shit. You know, no one believes this. It's maybe you got one person out of 10. If they went to college, they're more likely actually to be brainwashed or to believe in, you know, pluralism and, you know, civil society. But like most people, small businessmen, entrepreneurs, workers, regular folks, they don't believe this stuff. I mean, I think we are the silent majority.
Yeah, they don't actually know what is going on either. They just know whatever's on TV, it's probably BS, because
exactly,
it was
right.
BS last time, so... it's just prudence.
Right, right. So that's the basic, but yeah, backing up with and moving forward, that's the framework for understanding the failed state. And because we know that the U.S., you know, it's not like it was back in the 60s or 70s or the 80s during the Cold War, where the U.S. was just trying to like subvert democratic movements or to install dictators or, you know, and still have like a functioning society that produced whatever, some banana republic or oil producing, and then the U.S. just had control over it and then could extract the resources and then control the markets for the sale of finished goods, like in the classical colonial model. So I think a lot of people who built careers very accurately and coming from a good place, describing the U.S. empire during the Cold War, have really like kind of broken down and have failed to really understand the new goals of the empire, which is to kind of more create like a Mad Max world.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think people do understand the Banana Republic style method where, oh, they got oil or they have opium or they have this certain resource that we want to extract. And so the IMF goes in and destroys the country, and then we use exploited labor to extract that resource, you know, Alan Dulles style, old school model of destroying a country. Versus nowadays with a failed state, I don't think they quite understand the shift of the new strategy of breaking a country and forcing austerity and keeping that Western hegemony over the region by supporting basically extremists and crazies, which always causes stagnation, and it also boosts the arms industry, etc. I don't think people understand that war itself is a resource now. You don't have to have a particular monetary item to extract from the country. The chaos is a resource.
Right, exactly. And the thing, and then so then focusing on Ukraine, people, you know, let's say they saw behind the crap and they understood that the Orange Revolution 10 years ago, you know, ostensibly put in pro-NATO or pro-Western and anti-Russian candidates. Well, yeah, I mean, they put a lot of effort into this. They used, you know, the public civil disobedience. They organized some areas of labor for strikes. There were like, you had a lot of the things that are associated with the left in the West, such as civil disobedience, sit-ins, strikes, mass protests. But these were towards kind of more center-right, or but not in the classical sense, but neoliberal or neoconservative aims. But what happened is that even after this extraordinary...
Let me break those terms down, too. Neocon, sure. I think everyone in the U.S. is familiar with. Neoliberal, and the Americans would just call them liberal. But over in Europe, the liberals are the conservatives. And so they call them neoliberals. That's all that means. But we don't really have to have a neo. Liberals have always been warmongering statists. So.
Right, of course, right. I mean, the liberals and the neoliberal and the Washington consensus is like another word that neoliberalism or the Washington consensus, right? And it basically this is all also about tying countries to debt. And you have the IMF and World Bank as being big institutions in this neoliberal framework. So.
There's no doubt that was installed. I mean, Victoria Nuland basically let it all out in that leaked phone conversation where she was pushing Gatz to be the prime minister because he would accept the IMF austerity plan and he would reject the slightly less shitty Russian plan.
Right, right. It's a matter of interest rates in terms of austerity. Ultimately, what happened going back 10 years ago was that after all this effort, there's been some shift in U.S. thinking, and the U.S. produces very like top rate analysts, but the analysts are not the decision makers. The U.S. is not; it has a lot of meritocratic institutions within its decision making process, but it is not a meritocracy. So you do kind of have like the children of rich; you have rich kids, the children of rich people. Get promoted. They may not be on the very tip-top end of the IQ spectrum, but they hold the positions and they have to make the final decisions, and they kind of have to consult advisors and people beneath them who are more qualified, but the people making the decisions are being pulled by a lot of like things like favoritism and friendships and political bonds, and then
and nepotism, of course, like Joe Biden's son.
There you go. Right.
Or so, with when Paul Wolfowitz and Mark Zell They're all working for Chalabi's nephew, things like that.
Right. That's how it works. And so they didn't necessarily, and so they were definitely on board with anti-Russianism and as an extension of anti-communism, but a lot of them were like ignorant about like natural, in other words, a lot of them believed their own propaganda, and they were ignorant about kind of like what the culture of Ukraine is and how really closely connected and how very Russian Ukrainianism is. And they also ignored kind of, because they were thinking in Cold War terms, in terms of like democracy versus communism or capitalism versus socialism or whatever, they didn't understand that just the natural historic trend for Ukraine is to be pulled into the Russian sphere. So even after they did this whole effort with the Orange Revolution and they put in these people, within like 6 months or a year, these same people that the Americans installed had to make deals with the Russians and basically develop the same ties that had existed before 2004. So overall, what ended up happening is over a 10-year period, there wasn't any real significant move in the mainstream political sphere or in the economic sphere. In fact, Russian and Ukrainian ties continued to develop. And so they basically, the only difference was that they were able, since the 90s, to create political space for like these extremist militias, these Pravi sector neo-Nazi groups to kind of flourish and grow and get their radio going and their newspapers and their local meetings and get their, you know, funding from these nefarious NGO sources that you've so eloquently described for us. And so that basically led to finally a breaking point where a lot of the things happening in Syria and drawing Russia in and Iran in, and you've got, you know, Hezbollah and Lebanon and the fight over Syria and Assad. Then they needed to they decided that now was the time to like open up the front in Ukraine and draw in the Russians. And then, you know, without jumping forward too much, they need to escalate things in Chechnya and Dagestan over by the Caspian. And so they want to draw Russia in to be kind of like on two fronts ultimately, and then have them unable to basically help Iran and Syria so that Israel and maybe the Saudis can increase their hegemony in that region.
Right. And it's Russia's last base on the Mediterranean is in Syria, so that would give NATO a monopoly over the waters there. And of course, the whole plan for Syria is written straight up by the Israelis. And of course, the Saudis always support whatever the U.S. is doing because half the monarchs are installed and propped up by the United States to begin with.
Right.
But they need that Wahhabi Islam as the front. I mean, that's been the old privateer model that we went over last time. But what is the Russian strategy in Ukraine, the counter attack, as it were? Because they see this coming. They know what's coming in Chechnya. And I mean, that's been going on for years and years as well.
Right. Yeah. It's they saw it coming and they've been planning for this. And in fact, you know, it's to sort of like frame the question, because I think you've asked the key one, is that going back actually 80 years, what the Russian Revolution accomplished was very similar to Napoleon's reforms in France in the, you know, 120 years before that. And what that was basically like creating a scientific bureaucracy. And that's something that like the Tsar didn't really have, and why the Tsar was not too difficult to overthrow. And without getting into like the details of like conspiracy and, you know, who benefited and who was behind it and all that kind of, you know, stuff, what was developed was like a more rational bureaucracy, so to speak. I'm not saying that rational means that it's good or that there's freedom involved, but just in pure mechanical objective terms, a rational bureaucracy. And what they understood, and moving forward past World War II, is that they understood that because of MAD, that mutually assured destruction, and the nuclear situation, that the way that the USSR or Russia would be destroyed would be a combination of kind of like local guerrilla wars and, you know, being destroyed at the periphery and infiltration and intrigue and agents. And that's why like the whole spy thing was so big. That's why Afghanistan was so important. That's why Poland in 84 and again in 89 was so important. And that's why the U.S. like pushed so hard at breaking up the Balkans in the 90s and in the 80s, pulling the Eastern European and Central European Warsaw Pact states out of the Soviet sphere, ultimately leading, of course, to the disintegration of the USSR in 93. And even though, like, the world media, so to speak, in the West presented this picture of, like, a new Russia, and, you know, now the whole world's democracy, there's no more, you know, Cold War, and everyone's happy and shit like that, and Francis Fukuyama said this is the end of history. the whole time, like, the Russians...
The Cold War was always about fighting a rival power. It had nothing to do with fear of communism or anything like that.
You have a rival geostrategic interest. And this is something that, like, Reich and Mackinder understood back, you know, 80, 70, 60, 70 years ago. This is, like, what has been talked about by, like, Brzezinski and Kissinger. And they don't care about communism or capitalism or anything. It's just a very mechanical, objective analysis of the heartland or the centerpiece on the grand chessboard and how you basically, like, surround it and cut it off.
I think a very key operation that, because people wonder, well, did they really believe in this domino theory, or were they just using that as a pretext to screw with Central America and wherever they wanted to have a military presence? And Operation Washtub really blows the lid off all of it, because that's the case where they went and planted Soviet weapons and then went and discovered the weapons they put there themselves, meaning they knew there was no threat of communism. And still did it. So, I mean, it's obvious that they didn't really buy into the domino theory. It was just something to sell to the public.
Right. That's the thing. And it's like, what was happening in Latin America.
It's ridiculous anyway. Oh, right. Your neighbor believes this. So suddenly everybody in America is going to change their economic philosophy. Like, how is that? Right. It's just such a stupid scare tactic.
It is. But it works, right? It works.
It did work. Yeah, absolutely.
So then you got basically, to kind of narrow in on the question, is that so the Russians are basically having a rational bureaucracy, planning through the Cold War, understanding the dynamics of change, and trying to understand U.S. tactics, because the U.S. wants to create a failed state, and because anything resembling like normal, like people, like kids going to school, people going to work, like, you know, whatever, we're talking about a society that has classes and hierarchy and order and like police, and maybe you have elections or you don't, but whatever, you have running water, you have, you know, people know their neighbors and kids go to school and stuff like that. That is dangerous for the U.S. because basically Ukraine, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Czech Republic and Slovakia are right in the middle there. And so long as if those countries are like developing economically and things are basically normal, then they're bringing Western Europe together to Russia because they sit right in the middle, and like the roads and the railroads go right through, the gas pipelines go right through, like people go to school and they become experts in something, and they might go work in Berlin or London, or they might go work like in Moscow or Beijing, and then people buy things and sell things, like they grow wheat or they make medical supplies or tractor parts, and they can sell them to the Russians or to the Western Europeans. And they also buy things from both people. And basically what the U.S. understands is that trade brings people together, and that when people share like a common resource, like a stream, like in primitive civilizations, that creates like a common culture. And like, you know, so like a modern day equivalent of a stream is like highways and gas pipelines and railroads and airplane flight paths. And those are things that bring, you know, modern and postmodern civilizations together. And so the U.S. has benefited from two world wars in playing kind of like both sides against the middle and whatever, and back in the Nazis and back in the Soviets, back in the English against the French and the French against, you know, that whole game, just to basically create constant competition, animosity, fear, and now to create failed states and war. So the Russian counterposition is just, you know, it doesn't really matter to them. They don't like Poroshenko. They don't like what's happening. But anything that involves something normal is better than a complete failed state. And so the Russian angle is, ideally they would like to keep, and this is something that people don't want to hear, but I'm going to be honest, if I may, is that they would like to keep Novorossiya as an autonomous entity that is within Ukraine, because then it, because those people then have an influence on the broader Ukrainian discourse, a political outcome in the culture. But if those people have their own republic, or if it's part of the Russian Federation, then you just basically have the stump of Ukraine to the west, which is more, they have a different religion in general, they speak a different language, and they're more prone to be pulled into the Polish and German sphere of influence, which is fine also, don't get me wrong, because all of those spheres are coming together anyway for the reasons we listed. But in terms of the U.S. creating disorder and animosity, it doesn't work out that way. But I don't think that the Russians now think that this is so much possible. What they really want to see happen is a regime change in Kiev so that the government is no longer pursuing a war. It'll probably ultimately happen, Rai, that the places that are being called Novorossiya, really Lugansk and Donetsk, which are oblasts in the east of the country, north of there is Kharkov Oblast, which probably will ultimately go over to Novorossiya. And it is another alternate plan, because they have all these contingencies. They don't just have like one plan. An alternate plan would be for those to break off and be an autonomous republic within the Russian Federation, as opposed to within the Ukraine Federation. And the more that the U.S. is able to foment mayhem and war, the less likely it is that the Novorossiya will be part of a federal Ukraine. And to add on to that is because another...
The right. last one, but I this would be a question for a lawyer, but I'm wondering, were they to join a Russian Federation, or even, I have this question about Crimea too, since they did join the Russian Federation, what happens to the 15 billion euros in debt that Ukraine has? Do they say, hey, that's not our debt because we're not part of Ukraine anymore, up yours, or are they responsible for part of that, or what?
Right. That's the argument. And in fact, you know, people don't want to hear this either, but the Russians may be able to help Poroshenko get out of this, but it's going to, and I write this in my article, it's going to depend on how they've assessed Poroshenko. I mean, if he's just a clown who's doing a job and they're going to give him a couple billion dollars and, he's going to live in Switzerland or something in 6 months, then he doesn't really care. But if he's had that taste of power, I mean, he's a businessman, not a politician.
He's a chocolate billionaire. That, like,
right. He's already a billionaire, the chocolate king, man. But the problem is that this happened with Karzai in Afghanistan, right? Because he was an ExxonMobil employee and he was high up in the chain of command there. And then they installed him in Afghanistan. But because he was in the position, he got that taste of power, even though he was a puppet, you know, in his own little court, it was in his own little world, he had like power, right? And he did make decisions about like where the army goes and how much to invest in this. And, you know, the kind of the micromanaging shit, he did have power. And just to control Kabul and just to like make agreements with, like, at the time it was like the Northern Alliance and then, you know, the Taliban and, you know, all these different groups. And to also to have normalized relations with Pakistan, like he had to kind of save face and he had to start pushing against the Americans. The same thing happened with Milosevic at the end of Yugoslavia. The same thing happened with Saddam Hussein, right, where basically he was kind of like a USP, was installed by the CIA. It was kind of like a counter-Ba'athist coup within the Ba'athist party in the 70s. And then, you know, they gave him money to pursue a war against Iran. And that's why he thought that he could make the war against...
they covertly supported Iran through Iran-Contra and Israel.
That's right, and through Iran-Contra as well. So you could see that basically this is another rule in geopolitics. It's actually based in classical political theory. It goes back, without, you know, boring people too much, to Xenophon's tract. He was another student of Socrates, like Plato. And he wrote A Hero, the Tyrant, and this is like over 2,000 years old, 2,500 years old now. And he basically explains that the position of power consumes the man. The man does not consume the position of power. And so this is like kind of proven thing in psychology as well. So the Russians may have Poroshenko figured out or not a certain way. I don't know what they know. They have the dossier on him. I'm not privy to that, right? So, but in general, the thinking is that if
Poroshenko... Oh, you're not privy to that because I got emails today accusing you of being FSB.
Right, no, right, yeah.
I was like, relax, he's just an activist like me.
Yeah, I'm just an activist. I'm driven by heart here. It's a labor of love. No one's paying me. And, you know, would be nice.
We'd have nice suits and stuff.
Yeah, right, yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm not living on the street yet, so I must be an agent.
Right.
But yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm eating hand to mouth here, and you know, my fridge isn't full, and you know, I drive a 14-year-old car, but you know, it's like this, my friend. Basically, if Poroshenko wants to stay in power, he's going to need more and more Russian help, as weird as that sounds, and it's kind of like cuts against how everyone else is kind of thinking about this. But if you studied this for like 6 years and stuff, like I had to, and or if you're just someone who isn't satisfied with superficial knowledge and you keep digging and understanding the layers involved here, then you'll understand all these mechanisms. And so basically, the right now, phase three, to make the failed state, the U.S. is having to push Poroshenko to do things that will ultimately undermine his power. Because even though Poroshenko is a war criminal who has been installed by the U.S. and has done extremely dangerous and destructive things, both against Ukrainians and against ethnic Russians and Russians in the region, the fact that there's like a Rada and that there's like a constitution that gets trampled on, but it's there, the fact that all these things are kind of in place and they're still kind of like...
It's the only semblance of any kind of civil society left.
And right.
So he's the last by default, example. They have to cling to that.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, who wants just chaos?
The U.S. just wants chaos. That's who wants chaos.
Well, I mean,
and so they,
right. U.S. So doesn't the whole, have to live there. I mean, who living there wants the chaos?
No one living there wants the chaos. All the oligarchs who have their own private armies and stuff, they own homes in Hungary. They own homes in Germany and in France. And, you know, big, big homes and ski resorts and shit. And they don't need to live there. And they can visit the Ukraine failed state whenever they want. Just have like, you know, a small army of 40 or 50 bodyguards, like in, you know, armored out Hummers and Jeeps and stuff. And they can go to the whorehouses or wherever they want to go or, you know, in Ukraine. And they can party or whatever. And they can feel Ukrainian for, you know, 10 weeks out of the year and then go back home to Switzerland. And that's kind of like, you know, what the U.S. can do. And similarly, there are some like, you know, resources and points of extraction where they can build little micro states that are basically like army bases that you might have like 2,000 or 3,000 mercenaries guarding a facility like in the Middle East where they have these so-called ISIS people and the oil fields and stuff. And there are some resources in Ukraine. There are some like coal mines and stuff. And if the U.S. wants to like dig that out and then sell it back to the Europeans who had access to it in the first place through normal trade, but if the U.S. can like raise the premium, and they can put little small mercenary armies into little areas that are maybe like 10 or 20 square kilometers large, right? And then just extract the resources from that point. So you don't need like a whole state that has like people and government and schools and hospitals and doctors and roads and shit like that. If you all you want to do is just pull out, that's just cream on the top. I mean, that's just butter, you know. They don't even need that either. That's just like, they might get people to buy in or, you know, nepotism or just, you know, there's some local, there's always like small things to take care of on the ground level. And if you can like make some people happy who are working for you by doing stuff like that, they'll do it. If they can't, they can't. But anyway, that's a general idea. So the Russians are basically just trying to keep, they're being actually, and this may be hard for people to hear, but the Russians are being the most responsible party in this. And I think that's why I get accused of being a Russian agent, but I'm just being objective here. I'm from the United States.
Well, they're being pragmatist, and they've got the long haul in sight. They have more in it. I mean, They need to look long term. The U.S. is just looking for quick profits and breaking another state. That's all these neocons know how to do is export chaos.
That's what they're doing. I mean,
they react to their own blowback all the time. But they see, it's like they it's not really unintended consequences. It's who cares what the consequences are, because whatever kind of conflict comes down the pipe, we can profit from it.
Exactly. That exactly. And that's why, you know, it's like they want to draw basically with so the Russians are basically trying to keep things localized, contained. They're not trying to like create any unnecessary divisions. They treat Poroshenko with basic respect. They've come closer to deals. You know, we have winter coming, and it looks like the Ukrainians may be able to buy gas. I know that people who are emotionally invested, and even intelligent people who have thought halfway through this, are telling, yeah, Russia's going to cut off the gas. That'll force the situation. Like, no, that's what the U.S. wants, right? They want Russia to turn off the gas. I mean, it's really the Pravi sector that might end up, or, you know, U.S. people dressed up like Pravi sector might end up blowing up these gas lines, because that's what they want. They want these things, which are the ties that bind, to be unbound. And if the Ukrainians don't have access to Russian gas, yeah, like millions of people are going to die of like freezing, and the economy is going to collapse even further than it's already collapsed. Their currency is already like down the tube. It's only, I think, 25% of its, basically it's been like inflation has reduced 75% of the value of the currency already in that neighborhood.
Yeah, but and Gazprom isn't Russia. It's a private company, and they could very well say, look, if you don't have the money for this, we're not going to sell it to you. The hell with you. We'll sell to China.
Right. They can do that. And the Chinese, there are, you know, other people want that gas. It's not like, see, the thing is that this doesn't hurt Russia.
It puts European pressure on it too, because they need the gas, but they need it to physically pass through Ukraine. And
right.
If that's something that they're not paying for, there's just going to be a huge black market for the gas that they siphon off that's supposed to go to Europe.
Yeah, you might want to explain that, because the gas that goes through Ukraine is how it gets to Europe. Actually, it's...
Okay, we should. So you can't just take gasoline around on trucks and things. It comes through pipelines or by sea, which is not an option in this case until the South Stream line is built. And so... They physically have to pipe the gas through Ukraine to get to the rest of Europe, because it's just geographically in the way, is there, and that's where the pipelines already exist now that are functional. And so, and we could see what the PKK used to do this in Turkey. They can siphon gas off that's supposed to be headed toward destination A, let's say Germany or whatever, and create a large black market. Because if they're saying, well, we're not selling gas to you because you can't pay for it, well, they'll steal it. I mean, that this is the same as any kind of prohibition on anything.
Right.
It creates a mob.
Right. And if the gas were to be cut off, now this gas, because the South Stream hasn't been built yet, but Bulgaria and Serbia are on board with it, and it, you know, every couple of weeks there's an article that, oh, there's been a setback, but you know, I'm here in Serbia and construction is happening and everything else is just kind of like noise and chatter and background noise and political talk. But as it is right now, there's Nord Stream, and that is about 30%+ of the natural gas flow from Gazprom, and then there's the Ukraine pipeline, and that's the other 60%+. And so the South Stream will take pressure off the importance of the one through Ukraine, but that's going to take another year or two to complete. And what the Russians don't want to happen is for the gas to be cut off to Europe through Ukraine, because setting aside the human catastrophe, what ultimately would happen is that Ukraine would, at extreme cost, which they can't afford, have to find other ways of getting fuel or ways of powering it.
And it's going to be a very, very cold winter.
It will be a very cold.
The ironic thing is that the one other source of gas, which does have a line going north, that they could have purchased it from is Iran. But of course, there are sanctions on Iran.
Right. Brilliant. Brilliant. So, you know, they, you know, but the Russians don't want Ukraine to go cold. They don't want Ukraine to have to find alternate sources of energy. I mean, logistically, it's not really possible. And when I don't want to confuse the issue, making Ukraine get power from other places will not be enough to heat people's homes. So people, the unemployment in Ukraine is somewhere between 50% and 70%. Plus, you have all the people over 58 or 61 are retired and on pensions, and they have a very limited fixed income, and they already depend on credit, and they already depend on not freezing in the winter. And the costs of, there won't be enough fuel, first of all, to power industry and heat homes. And secondly, it will cost so much that people won't afford it and they will freeze to death. But even past that catastrophe, in purely, you know, bigger macro terms that doesn't take into account the human catastrophe, Ukraine would be forced to find its fuel from other places, and that would be the US's aim realized. That would be that would be one of the realizations of the US aim, as well as creating the failed state. So all this talk about the war and the
foresight of that winter coming is why there are so many ethnic Russians fleeing across the border into Russia.
Right. It's been over a million, and it's being so underreported in the West that it is. I mean, Western media is just a criminal network, and I just want to say something that on the legal precedent established in international law, so-called international law, through the Nuremberg trials, I'm going to get a little bit emotional here, but I don't think these fucking bastards, Rye, for CNN and the BBC and the New York Times, I think that they have some kind of arrogant or sociopathic or Aspergian detachment from reality. These people don't realize that they are the war criminals, that creating the propaganda, that spreading the intentionally spreading the disinformation and misinformation and the lies and creating the whole paradigm that this is exactly what went down in Nuremberg. These are the things that Goebbels and folks were charged and convicted of in post-World War II courts. And these are the things that these people are guilty of today. And if they think that the American Empire even has that much gas left in it, if these people think that they're gonna outlive the collapse and that they're going to get off scot-free, I think they're fucking wrong. I think these people need to be arrested at the earliest possible time and brought to trial. And that will only happen after some revolution in the United States or a major defeat of the U.S. empire, a period of truth and reconciliation, and an international consortium forced upon the U.S. or a native revolution in the U.S. to bring people to justice. And that's the only way it can go down.
Yeah, they sold the Iraq War, too, and that was New York Times. And I guess Judith Miller did go to jail, but for another reason, leaking on the plame affair. She sat in there for 85 days. But yeah, they really have no accountability because their job is to sell the Pentagon's talking points, and then the Pentagon is selling the Israeli talking points. And it's just chaotic. And you're right, they're absolute psychopaths. They could give a damn about these children in Ukraine or the lives they're affecting. They don't care. It's like, I'm on the winning team, F you.
Right.
They're just disgusting and immoral, and it is really uniform. And if people want a very blatant example on how controlled the media is, just look at Palestine. Look at the West Bank. It's being ethnically cleansed and racially colonized. And there's not one single newspaper or television channel that will just plainly say there's a military occupation. Even in the middle of the violence, which is about every 2 years or so, where Israel goes down and destroys homes, hospitals, etc., not one single paper, magazine, or news channel says, oh, by the way, did you know that these settlements are Jewish-only, you know, exclusive cities that their military stole from? By force from the native, not one. And you think, well, some journalists would say something. They can't, because it's top down. They read talking points. Our media literally has government talking points issued to them to read off the teleprompters. It is completely state run. There is no free press when you're talking about mass media in the United States. All right. The propaganda you heard about the Soviet Union applies to America. That's our media. They are there to sell you wars and bullshit, scare you with Ebola, whatever the new crap is now.
Right.
Which, of course, an Israeli company is now selling medicine for. That's their role, to scare the shit out of you, lie to you, and get you to hate foreigners.
You know, it's these people...
You can cuss on my show and be emotional.
Okay. Well,
I think that's the perfect time to cuss. I mean, yeah, I'm not big on swearing or anything, but damn, when you're talking about children getting murdered, that's what these words are for.
Right. That's what these words are for. And these people are the worst war criminals in history as we understand it. And they are the ones in power. And the soon as people wake up...
they're literally supporting Nazis right now.
Literally, they are supporting
and
Nazis right now.
And
you know,
Zionist.
Right, so-called Islamofascists or whatever, you know, and Zionist, and just, you know, it's kind of like, it's like watching Austin Powers and seeing like Dr. Evil's round table of villains, and the U.S. is supporting each and every one of those, you know, and it's like, it's almost, and the thing is that it's exactly what, you know, Goebbels said, it's a lie so big, and it's like so crazy that it's hard to believe, and that's why... that whatever remaining 30% of people who occupy 70% of managerial positions believe it, you know. But most Americans don't.
It just amazes me that the U.S. can preach about any kind of humanitarian pretext or democracy or fairness around the world when they're supporting all these crazies, not to mention all these terrorist groups all over the Middle East and drug cartels all over South America. I mean, you pick a criminal group, and they're sponsored by the CIA and NATO. It is the evil empire.
It is the evil empire. And it's just, you know, these journalists
are not
journalists.
They've murdered millions. They don't have a leg to stand on.
You know, it's these journalists, Rye, are not journalists. They don't know what critical thinking or investigative reporting is. I don't know what their 90 IQ, they've got three brain cells to rub together.
These they're double-digit IQ, Hasbara talking parrots, I mean, that's all.
Yeah, they're, you know what? These people are narcissists and actors who want to see themselves on TV and have just a very, they have a stupid man's idea of what running in high circles is, I guess. And they just, you know, and they have a stupid man's idea of what news is.
And a dumb portray of evil. They get up and put their makeup on their face and read the teleprompter. It's not journalism.
Mom, I have a job.
Look, I read what someone tells me to.
Yeah. So, you know, and that breaks down to how it's happening in Ukraine, and the Western reporting on it has been catastrophic. And it's, you know, so what's happening now is, you know, to kind of like tie that up, is that, to be clear, the U.S. is backing Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk, who are also from different organizations whose groups ran against each other in yesterday's election. And they're also backing the Pravi sector groups, and they're also backing Svoboda. And these are all like a spectrum of like neo-Nazis ranging to neoliberals and neoconservatives. So some of them are kind of like openly Nazis, and others are just kind of like neocons, and they're, you know, friends with Kagan and Nuland and stuff like that. And so that's how the U.S. is now getting them to like increase the tension.
Jewish supremacists instead of a white supremacist.
Yes, like, exactly.
Would you rather get hit in the left nut or the right nut? I mean,
yeah, right.
Not a choice.
Or no, yeah. So that's what it is. And now the U.S. is pushing them against each other in order to create a failed state. And if a failed state doesn't get created, it's not because they changed their mind. The future is not written. It's just that, like, there is such a thing as international community. It's not the U.S. and NATO, but there is an international community. There is a BRICS New Development Bank. There are countries who, for their own, like, I'm not an idealist, okay, but for their own, like, pragmatic, objective reasons and their own trajectories, like, they're like, hey, war doesn't work for us. And, you know, having a Ponzi scheme, you know, inflationary bubble that is going to infect our, you know, markets and our banks is not good for our economy.
Yeah, so they can't do the imperialist model because they don't have the strongest military, so they have to think of another option. It's not out of any kind of government benevolence. It's for their own survival. Right. And their own BRICS survival. Bank could be just as bad as the IMF or World Bank. However, I don't think so because I think it's a good thing because the more options and competition there is out there, even if they're all bastards, the better it is because the more you consolidate monopolies, the worse things get. So having another option out there with a BRICS bank is definitely a plus.
Right. And basically, geopolitically and geostrategically, the more that different countries can form like different blocks that are all from basically not, you know, world-class imperial powers, you're going to have multipolarity. And when you have like a single, think of the American Empire as like a monopoly as a single global hegemon, and all these like movements to create multipolarity are creating, you know, on the one hand, from an anthropological perspective, they're preserving local cultures and traditions and languages, and you know, people are turning against kind of like the MTV and VH1 and CNN and you know, Fox News life and you know, that whole like sphere of the world, and you know, even TV shows like Sex and the City and stuff like that are being rejected. And there are local elites that have an interest in that. And sometimes the interests of that also lines up with the interests of history and of local cultures and historical traditions. And that's all good too. So what's really happening now is gonna be where the US may not be a totally failed state in Ukraine. There's no going back though. I mean, let's be clear. There's no going back. The people in Novorossiya will never want to be part of a single unitary Ukrainian state. That'll never happen.
After they just got attacked by Kiev.
It just won't happen. It just can't happen. I mean, not in this generation and not in the next one. I mean, if you want to look at 75 or 100 years from now, I can't project that far out, but not in the foreseeable, not anyone who's alive today who's 10 years old and not until they're 70 years old, right?
Right.
So that's just how it's going to be. And if World War doesn't break out because of, I mean, if the kind of, you know, whether we're in World War right now or not is debatable, but an escalation of the World War may not occur, but it's not because the U.S. changed its mind. I mean, when I'm talking about the Ukraine failed state and World War III or World War IV, if you will, it's not a foregone conclusion because, you know, the Russian sphere and the Iranian sphere and the Chinese may defeat the U.S. effort. I mean, that's not, you know, that's another thing in the West is that people hate the empire, but they also think it's like indestructible, and it's not. So, you know, things might not end up, I mean, they're already really bad, Ryan. Let's not get that confused, but they don't have to get too much worse. But it's not because the U.S. changed its mind. It's just that the U.S. may be foiled. They might get foiled. They could lose this one, and that would be great.
Yeah, well, by the U.S., we mean the people that run it.
Yeah, I'm not talking about
a bunch of multinational corporations.
I'm not talking about American people who basically want the same thing as people everywhere else, to be able to have, you know, life and pursue their hobbies and have friends and families and have jobs that are partially meaningful and to, you know, sleep well at night and stuff like that. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, of course, the international conglomerates who are using the U.S., you know, war machine and
of course. The U.S. attracts most of the corporate parasites because it has the strongest military. And so naturally they're going to gravitate to try to control that sphere because they've got the army, which can enforce all their debauchery around the globe. And they've been using the CIA for that. Also, that's the drug war management arm. And then, of course, all the mercenary groups out of the U.S., Blackwater, etc., which are a little bit easier to go in and do overt activities. So that's the reason there are so many parasites on the United States. And we've got to break this relationship between business and state. I mean, if you get the state out of the marketplace, then you wouldn't have all this corporate welfare and you wouldn't have all this overt corporate interest warfare either, because the state is the enabler and facilitator of all of it. They cannot do it on their own. They have to have a host. And so that's why we've got to put, as Americans, a lot of pressure on our government, locally and on the state and especially the federal level, to end this relationship. I mean, everybody understands and I think can agree corporate welfare and bailouts to banks and things like that. No, it's got to end. Nobody supports that. And yet they just do it anyway, right in your face, and they still get reelected. It just blows my mind. Why people would ever vote for an incumbent. I don't understand it.
Right. I mean, what you're getting into is political theory. But it's also like political reality, right? And it's a tough question, right? Really, because I mean, having economic power.
Well, they're playing game theory and we're watching game shows. You know, that's
right.
The problem.
They're doing game theory. We're watching game shows. And, you know, it's like they're living the life and we're watching, you know, we're watching them on TV live it. Psychology, in television, media psychology, that's called aspirational programming. And you ever like try to wonder why they show the Kardashians and why they're showing. You know, like ever since Robin Leach had Lifestyles and the Rich and Famous, and ever since
it's the vicarious shows like lifestyle, Dallas and Dynasty.
What's that?
It's a vicarious lifestyle where they can live through the characters on the box.
Right. And it's the best thing people can do. I mean, to be honest, it's like kind of like hearing about war in Ukraine and Prabhu Sector and Podoshenko. It's like the best thing people can do is to like take their TV and like, throw that shit out the window. I mean, it's just crap. And people, stop living through the people on TV. Like, if you want to watch sports, whatever, you know, or occasional, fine. But I mean, it's like, if you see beautiful people on TV, and if that's important to you, go be beautiful. Go to the gym. Start running. You know, like, do improve yourself. Like, if you see people living in beautiful homes, whatever, then, you know, learn something about architecture. Team up with some construction crew, you know, get resourceful, build something, add on to your house if you have one or, you know, but it's like, but stop living aspirationally.
Go run a bank, give somebody a loan they can't pay, foreclose on their house and steal their property from them. No.
Right. No. I mean,
that's one way to get a house.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's like, but the main thing is for people to stop living vicariously through these TV people. And when you stop watching TV, guess what? There's no more CNN. There's no more, you know, Miller selling the Iraq war. There's no more.
Yeah, you'll be healthier if you just stop. I mean, turn off your television so that you are not constantly inundated with fear. There's just a low level degree of fear consistently and continuously pumped into the brains of people watching television. Everything, even the dramas with the cop and lawyer shows, people getting killed and stuff all the time, and there's always some epidemic disease or whatever, and there's the fear porn from Alex Jones as well. That stuff is paralyzing. You've got to turn that off, step one, and you'll feel a lot better.
You feel so much better, and, you know, it's like, and the information is bad. So if you want to be informed, you know, it's there's so many other venues. I mean, you've got there's ANC, and there's Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has good stuff.
Yeah,
there's all
Boy
kinds
and Frogs
of people.
Is a good one.
Yeah, there's Moon of Alabama is not bad, and there's you know there's just if you wanna, it's like there's people, and you know some people are coming from kind of like a leftist or post-Marxian perspective, or some people are communists, other people are libertarians. Some people still identify more as leftist, and other people still identify more as rightists. I'm not pushing on that point because I think people are arrive at those positions for lots of complex reasons. But there are great writers, whether you're Pepe Escobar or whoever,
tomorrow.
Hey, I can't wait to hear that show. That's going to be amazing.
We're going to talk about Hong Kong. It's going to be some good stuff. It always is. It's always fun to have.
Yeah. No, that's going to be a great show. And, you know, a lot of people who, you know, libertarians call statists, and a lot of people who, you know, people on the left would call libertarians, you know, like anarchaps or, you know, whatever, or idealists or whatever. And, I mean, these are divisive. I mean, everyone understands that this, like, government corporate monstrosity in the American empire is the main problem. And
unify against the redheads, man.
We were saying that last time. Yeah. The soulless redheads. No, I said last time my father was a redhead, and I grow a lot of red hair in my beard actually. But what it is now is like, you know,
I can't talk to you now.
I'm one of the soulless people, right?
I don't believe in souls anyway, so that doesn't bother me.
Oh, right. Soulless. That's right. Yeah.
I'm an atheist.
So I guess soulless, right?
Yeah.
We're all soulless. It's like we got
except for James Brown. He had like 200 souls.
He did. Yeah. I mean, it was like this. Look, man. Like the fact that, you know, Lavrov is Russia's foreign minister to like inform your audience, and like the things that he says are like really important to follow, and mostly you'll find on there's a lot of like websites in English that are from Russia that like say the things that he has said, and I'm not saying that what he says is gospel, but I'm going to get to that point in 10 seconds. But Russia Today is like a good place to find Lavrov's statements. And what's like so cool about Lavrov's statements is that if you like either on the surface of them or reading between the lines, he's basically communicating like the Russian position. And he has already, what I say in my article that I published 2 days ago on the Ukrainian failed state on my website, I work for Center for Syncretic Studies at syncreticstudies.com, that the latest article of October 26, deep in there we get into basically Lavrov's statements, and we compare Lavrov's statements publicly about ISIS and why Russia is not allied with the U.S. in its fight against ISIS, even though Russia is also against ISIS, right? And I take those statements about ISIS and Syria, and I compare statements he's already made, and I am projecting he will make about the Pravi sector. Because it's lining up like at a 1-to-1 ratio. And these are just among the many reasons that I have developed this thesis that the Pravi sector are the Wahhabis in Ukraine. And they will be used in every sense of the word the same way that Wahhabis are used in the Middle East, in the Near East.
Yeah, that's basically what I outlined in War by Deception. It was a movie about 9/11, but I was talking about Syria, and I was just giving examples of like when they do this other area, and whether it's Central America or Eastern Europe, it will be this, and this will be the style of the privateers, because they use religion in one area where that's a hot button, they'll use race in another where that's a hot button, to any kind of thing, anything that'll create sectarian violence, they will utilize it, and that's just the method that's been going on for at least 50 years with all these intelligence agencies. But it's over an hour now, so I'll just encourage people to go to your site and read the report. And you can see the Lavrov bullet points on the Ukraine situation as well as on ISIS, ISIL, is whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And the Syria and Iraq situation there. You've got these 4 points on each of those. It's nicely laid out. It's a little wordy in the beginning, but just go through it, folks, because this really lays out the theory. Some things you just have to write down and sit down and read. It's a lot harder to articulate on the spot in like a radio format. But all the names are here. And of course, you know, the advantage of reading these things on a computer is if you haven't heard something, you just cut and paste it, drop it in Google, do a quick search, then come back to the article. If you don't know what 4GW is, you can go look it up. If you don't know what somebody is, then go put their name in. I mean, avoid Wikipedia, but other than that, you should be safe. I mean,
right, yeah. It's you know, it was a piece I've been developing for a couple weeks or more, and it's something that, look, it actually, if I don't recommend printing the internet, okay? But if you print it out like or put it in Word, it comes out, it's like 15,500 words, it's over 50 pages and footnotes. But it's basically a research paper, okay? It is a report, it's not an article. It's for people who really, really want to dig in. This is my sixth installment. All of my documents are long. I don't write every day. I'm not looking for web hits. The people I'm responsible to don't want me writing journalism. I'm doing kind of academic type of, you know, reporting, and it you know, it digs in very deep, and I explore things from basically different schools that like are in the university system, like the School of Geopolitics, School of International Relations, Social Psychology, Marketing and Media, and Military Theory. And I basically take, and I also include ideology and religion, and I try to take what's called an interdisciplinary approach. So I take different disciplines and I fuse them to kind of parse out the truth from the lies. And what I do is not unique, but I am trying to kind of expose
without any kind of partisan tribalism to the left or right or any of that nonsense.
That's right. That's right.
Or any particular country or anything. It's not like that. It's just neutral. I enjoyed it. I like reading that stuff. I like academic papers, but that's what I like doing shows about it to get people interested so they'll read it, because you link to something and they look and see how long that is and thick it is and they say, uh-uh.
But, yeah, I know.
I hope I've sparked interest. And you look, this, it's not just about Ukraine. If you understand the Ukraine situation, you understand the system. You understand the system that they use over and over again, area by area. It's not that different of a model that they're using in Syria, in Iraq, all over Africa. It's the same kind of game, players, propaganda, pretext, and usually the same corporations and neocons and media talking heads. It's all the same people and all the same plans. So if you can understand any of these situations, then you'll understand the rest of them a lot faster, because they're very similar to one another in the systematic sense and on the macro level.
That's right. I'm not very good at plugging myself, but for people who just don't have the time or patience or wherewithal to like get into my kind of little mini books that I write, I have with, you know, Maurice Herman, who's a former journalist with Press TV and did work with RT. He has his channel, Morris 108. I've done maybe 50 interviews that are like under 10 minutes, audio and video there. I talk about a range of subjects, mostly revolving around things that we talked about today.
I need to go on and do that, by the way, remind myself.
Yes, yes.
I haven't. Good. I don't know why I should.
So yeah, for people who like to hear stuff, or they plug stuff into their phone and they just take it with them on the bus or to work or whatever, I have, you know, smaller audio pieces and video. Also with Time Monk Radio and Paul Plain, I've done 3 shows that are about the link that we've just done now. And he presses some good questions too. So yeah, I'm trying to do multimedia and the kind of things for different audiences. I've also been published alongside Pepe Escobar at Oriental Review, and I will be contributing regularly to them, also to Countercurrents out of India, as well as the Greenville Post. Will be running my articles regularly, and I will be like producing shorter, like 1 to 2,000 word, like 1-page, 2-page stuff that's not as turgid, not as academic, but still, you know, get into the real shit.
You should jump on uns.com. That's where a lot of us are.
I need to.
Yeah, you should do that, and I should do the Morris 1-8-1. Yeah. All right, man. Well, take care, and yeah, I hope people get more interested in your work, and we need more activists like yourself. You know, you're helping carry in the water, and this is all, you know, a lot. One person can do a lot, and I think you do have a good handle on Ukraine, and keep on keeping on. It's the the best we can do is explain it. I think there's been a lot of damage done both on Ukraine and Syria, Iraq, etc., by just a few people speaking out and calling a spade and telling it like it is. They have been able to implement everything they would have otherwise, because they've been getting called out on it from the chemical weapons BS, etc. Nobody's buying into it anymore, as you stated earlier. Nobody believes the propaganda anymore, but the most base or brainwashed. Otherwise, they're starting to fail in that war, and that's all it takes. If we can reach up to 18%, we win. That's right. Mathematical certainty.
All right. That's right.
Yeah, it is. I'm optimistic. People all pet, oh, well, the NWO and all that. I hate terms like that.
Yeah.
Stop being scared. Yeah. Look, we can change this shit. Just get off your ass and get to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're not paralyzed, these people are not elite. They're not superior. A lot of them just got jobs based on pure nepotism. A lot of them are morons. Right. Half Congress doesn't even believe in evolution. We're talking about absolute morons. We can crush these people.
You just got to stand up and fight. You know, it's half of the stuff, more than half of the stuff is, you know, gargoyles and paralysis. And, you know, these people are not, these people are not on a base on the moon. They're, you know, they well, look, maybe they are, but it doesn't matter if they're reptilians or whatever, you know, I mean, you know, that shit just don't fucking matter. These people have names. The crooks, the people that need to be brought to justice, we know who they are. You could make a list. It's not super long. And they need to be put on trial and just put away. And government needs to be reformed. Corporations need to get kicked out. Let business do business. Let government be government. Let people live their lives. Let's end the empire. And you know what? It starts with you.
Well, I think we're turning a corner. I think definitely we're turning a corner now. They're getting away with it, but this is the last throws they've got. They really did themselves in with the second Iraq War. That's when it all started to fall apart. And they're just flailing about like a little kid now, trying to attack everything they got left because they know the time is limited. The writing's on the wall. You know, the Fed had an audit a few years ago. I mean, everything is falling out of place for them. These neocons and these people in power are desperate. They know the other shoe hasn't dropped. It's going to come, and it's going to come hard when the rug gets yanked out from under America.
That's right.
It's all coming down.
It is.
All right, peace, man.
All right, see you.